Welcome back, everyone, to another exciting episode of True Crime on Easy Street, Thanksgiving edition.
Gobble, gobble.
Yeah. Happy Thanksgiving to everyone. Hope you have a safe and fun and filling Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Good luck with those leftovers tomorrow.
I know. Do you have your favorite leftover recipe that you use?
Yeah, just put everything in a bowl and mix it together and stick it in the microwave and like eat it. It all tastes the same anyway. What difference does it make? A little water and just make it into soup.
I like to do a sandwich situation or like take the rolls and make tiny sandwiches.
Oh yeah, that's cool.
A good one.
I'm like a turkey, a dressing, a cranberry sauce, gravy situation.
I'm coming to your house on Friday.
Lovely.
That sounds delicious.
That's a lovely leftover right there.
Yes. And but really we don't have a ton of leftovers because Shane's mother, my mother-in-law, Sharon, is like a wizard at cooking like the exact amount of food she needs for the exact amount of people that are going to eat at her house. I will never understand because I cook for an army. If there are three people coming to dinner, we're going to have enough for 10. Okay, I don't know how to do that.
So I'm not going to your mother-in-law's house on Friday. I'm coming to your house.
Well, I don't cook. I don't.
Yeah, but you'll have left. Oh, you won't have
no,
left.
That's what I'm saying.
Kelly, I'm coming to your house.
Okay. Yeah. That's pretty amazing that she can do that.
It is. Like she'll have cake left over. That's the only thing. Cause you have to make a cake,
but that's brilliant. Cause I cook a lot and I'm always victim to that, having too many leftovers and then they go to waste.
I'm your solution to that problem.
Okay. All right. You're going to be, but that's what Sharon, tell me your secret.
I know. And I think the secret is it looks like it's not enough, but it is. Mm-hmm. It is enough because it never looks like enough to me because I'm used to cooking.
But then everybody's full and everybody's,
Colin's, scraping out the last of the mashed potatoes over here. It's
perfect. Mm-hmm. Everybody's satisfied.
Yep,
I love it. Okay. So what is your favorite way to eat turkey on Thanksgiving? Scott, go.
I throw it into the air and try to catch it in my mouth. And if I don't catch it, the dogs get it. Is that what you were expecting?
No.
How about a sandwich? I like a sandwich.
Okay. Do you like your turkey fried, smoked?
Just cooked.
Baked.
Just not raw.
Just not raw.
Yeah. As long as it's cooked in some way, I'm not very particular. But gotcha. Yeah, and I don't eat turkey that often. Mm-hmm. And so I always look forward to Thanksgiving.
Okay. Katie, go.
I love a turkey. I like smoked turkey probably best. Mm-hmm. But I love a good just baked in the oven, all night situation turkey. Like my grandparents always like
with a bunch of stuff jammed inside it.
Yeah, I don't need to know about all that. Like I said, I've never actually made the turkey.
Have you ever had one of those turduckens?
Is that a turkey duck?
I don't know how the exact way that it goes, but here's how I think it goes. I think you start with a duck.
Okay.
And you put things in the duck, some sort of stuffing or whatever the ingredients are, and then you stuff that in a chicken, or either you do the chicken first and then stuff that in the duck. I don't remember.
This is off the rails.
I know.
But please continue.
Okay, and then you have the duck and the chicken there, and then you stuff all of that in the turkey, and then you cook it all. I have eaten turducken before.
You have?
And I will tell you who made it for me, and that was Jake Graves, who has been on the show before.
Aww. Was it good? I'm sure if Jake made it, I'm sure it was fantastic.
It was delicious.
Yeah, Jake's pretty good at the grill.
I think it literally took him
all day.
142 hours to make this.
No, I like duck, and I like chicken, and I like turkey, so I'm sure
it was so good. But my favorite way to eat turkey is probably which is new to our family, the new way of doing the fried turkey like the Cajun seasonings on there.
Cajun turkey.
And I am a sucker for spices.
It's easy to overcook a turkey to get it too dry or to get it a little bland, but we have come up with ways, especially what you just described, the Cajun, because you use an injector, right?
And, it's delicious.
Put it into the meat. So yeah, I've never had one of those that I complained about.
I know. All right, last question, and then we will get on to our story for the day. What are you thankful for, Scott?
Don't cry.
I won't.
I'm thankful for the two of you. This podcast is one of my favorite things. I look forward to it every week. I overdo it, as you guys have seen me do from time to time. It's my favorite Sunday at noon. is my favorite hour of the week.
You absolutely.
And I get to hang out with you guys.
Yeah, you absolutely live and breathe this podcast.
I do.
I think that the listeners should know that.
I do.
The amount of time that you spend.
Ridiculous.
It is a lot. You're very, very dedicated.
I'm already working on the next one right now.
You are. Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm doing with my phone.
I know.
No, but I love it. And I love you guys. And I'm very thankful for the two of you and for this podcast. So
that's
your
so
turn.
Sweet. Thank you. It shows.
Yeah.
Well, I am definitely thankful for the two of you and for this podcast.
All right. Don't steal my thunder.
I'm not. I've been wanting to do this for years. I mean, since probably about 2018.
Really?
2019.
Yeah.
I really wanted
to. So a couple
of
years before we started. Even.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I really wanted to do this. And I'm so glad that we do it. I love being able to relate to all the different people who come up and talk with me, mm-hmm. and they say, hey, have you heard of this case? Are they sending me messages or texts? And
it happens to me every week.
And I've had people mm-hmm. say, I'm right. so sorry that I'm bothering you. Let me just go ahead and say, you are not bothering mm-hmm. any of us. No. When you send us information or talk to us about a case, you're not bothering.
Unless you start sending me letters in the mail, but we will talk about that next week.
There's a little teaser for our first December episode. But yeah, so I am thankful for this podcast. I'm thankful for the people that I have met since we started this,
yeah.
who share this kind of weird, quirky hobby
yeah.
that we have.
True.
Because it's weird.
It's a thank you, Truman Capote.
Yeah. And there's a lot of weirdos out there who love it with us.
That's true.
And I'm thankful.
And we love them all.
I'm thankful for the weirdos.
Katie?
Okay.
Well, I'm not a very sentimental person, but I am thankful.
I will pretend to be surprised
since
if you like.
Scott said don't cry on us, but I am. I will piggyback on y'all and throw one more in there, but I'm also thankful for y'all. I love that we get together and do this every week. And
me
I'm
too.
Also thankful for all the people who listen, because then we just be talking into nothing, and we all we do appreciate.
Well, and for all
your,
we know, that's exactly what we're doing.
We get a little feedback.
I know we do, and we love all of our listeners, uh-huh. and even those that haven't found us yet. You're out there somewhere, and maybe you'll hear this one day and be new and realize mm-hmm. that we're mm-hmm. talking about you.
I was gonna say, I'm also thankful for our families that we get to give a hard time because they don't listen to this podcast.
Yes.
And the joke yes. never dies because they still don't listen.
Yeah, it wouldn't be nearly awesome. It wouldn't be nearly as funny if your husbands listened to this show.
Yeah.
It's much funnier that they don't, at yeah. least to me and to the three of us.
Right. KT had on a shirt today that was from an old episode of WKRP in Cincinnati. So if you know what that show is.
Was it Thanksgiving related?
It was a Thanksgiving shirt.
The one
about the turkey drop.
Yes.
And the quote is, go ahead with it, Scott.
As God is my witness, I thought turkeys could fly. They had a turkey drop out of a helicopter.
Yes.
Downtown Cincinnati, WKRP sponsored it.
And it splatted on the concrete.
Well, turkeys can't fly.
Yes.
So they dropped them out of airplanes.
Yeah, it was supposed to be
a... And they were splatting all over the parking lot. Yeah,
it was supposed to be a promotional thing to create interest in the radio station. And it did, but not in the way they intended.
Oh.
And there is a t-shirt that you can find. Yeah.
WKRP in Cincinnati was a fantastic show.
It was a
show.
Great show. Set in a radio station in Cincinnati. Lonnie Anderson was on it. Les Nessman was the character we're talking about. I forget the actor's name, but he was the one who came up with the idea for the turkey drop. And it went horribly wrong.
What a great show. So if you're just so full of Thanksgiving dinner and you just want to kick it back and veg out for a little bit and watch yeah. something, find some old episodes of WKRP in Cincinnati.
At least that one.
Yeah. And
at
watch it.
At least that one.
You'll enjoy yourself.
Yeah.
All right. So this week, we have a case that we are doing that is so near and dear to Scott's heart.
Yeah. I've been in love with this for a long time. And the thing is, 51 years ago today, if you're listening to this episode on the day that it drops on Wednesday,
the 23rd of November.
Yeah. It's the 51st anniversary of this occurrence.
51st.
That's right. It happened in 1971.
Oh my goodness. Well, I can't wait. So take it away, guys.
Okay, so today Katie is going to begin this story, and it's going to blast off like the opening sequence of a James Bond film, and it's going to end like a treasure-hunting whodunit straight out of an Indiana Jones adventure. And unlike most of the stories we tell here on True Crime on Easy Street, today everybody is going to root for the bad guy. There is a decent chance that no one in the audience today will believe a single word that we're going to tell you. And I don't blame you. When we get to the end of today's episode, you may find yourselves flabbergasted. Even the FBI has given up trying to figure out who D.B. Cooper was. There's your spoiler alert. We are not going to take a huge, gigantic bite out of this apple, because if we did, we would be chewing until the end of time. Consider this episode a sort of introductory course. This is D.B. Cooper 101. If you want to learn more about the case, we will tell you how to do that as we wind our way through this adventure. We met some interesting people along the way to preparing this episode, folks who are totally dedicated to trying to solve this case even today. We're going to tell you about a couple of them and how you can learn much, much more about D.B. Cooper from the two of them if you choose. In the meantime, strap yourselves in, put your seats in their upright positions, and secure your tray tables. You are about to board Northwest Orient Airlines Flight 305 on the day before Thanksgiving of 1971. The person in the pilot seat today is Katie Givens. You are cleared for takeoff.
Skyjacking was a national epidemic in the late 1960s and early 1970s. I asked Scott earlier if he remembered flying.
No, I was one when this happened.
And he had to remind me.
It's amazing what people forget about how old I am and how old I am not.
That has made my day. All
right. I take back everything I said about what I'm thankful for.
No, you don't.
No, I don't.
The passenger jet had become the next stagecoach, in the words of author Geoffrey Gray, who wrote Skyjack, The Hunt for D.B. Cooper. There had been over 100 hijackings in the first term of President Richard Nixon's presidency alone. That was from 1969 to 1974. So it had happened hundreds of other times since, but only one U.S. hijacking case remains unsolved to this day. And like Scott said, this event took place on Wednesday, November 24th, 1971, which is the day before Thanksgiving, which we all know is a busy travel time anyway. You get your Thanksgiving.
That
and your
might have
holidays.
Factored into the plan somewhere.
I'm sure it did. Yeah. Because that is usually like one of the busiest days at an airport.
Easy to get lost in the airport when everybody is at the airport.
So we're aboard Northwest Orient Airlines Flight 305. There's red, red, and more red. Northwest Orient Airlines stewardess Flo Schaffner was covered in it. The uniform, the lipstick, the nail polish. Her company hat had a bill and ear flaps. She was said to look something like Elmer Fudd, so Geoffrey Gray wrote in his best-selling book. Schaffner and the two other stewardesses on Flight 305, because that's what they were called at the time, stewardesses. Now they are flight attendants. The term stewardess, I understand, is not used today, but that is what they were in the 70s.
Yeah, that term has not been used in quite some time.
Yes. There on Flight 305, they had come aboard in Minneapolis earlier in the day, but the flight had begun that morning in Washington, D.C., and was skipping westward across the upper Midwest, headed for a final planned stop in Seattle. From Minneapolis to South Dakota, then Montana, next was Spokane, Washington, and now Portland. Only 36 more minutes to Seattle, and a long day for the crew of Flight 305 would finally be over. Tina Mucklow was the youngest of the three stewardesses. She was in the back of the plane with Flo Schaffner. There was a first-class stewardess up front, and there was a pilot, a co-pilot, and a flight engineer in the cockpit. So what? That is six crew on this flight.
That's how it started out.
Sitting on the tarmac in Portland, Flo and Tina board their passengers, 37 of them in all, using the aft stairway on the Boeing 727. This style of jetliner was popular with airlines because many smaller and mid-sized airports in the country still had not upgraded to jetways. So passengers had to walk across the tarmac and wait for the, is that Bluth Mobile?
Yeah, the Bluth Mobile, right? I mean, Bluth, you guys all watched Arrested Development, right? I mean, that's what they drove around in, was the pickup truck with the stairs on the back. And that's how you got off of an airplane, unless it had stairs built in.
Right, because most of the airplanes that you board today, you know, you are straight from the airport into the plane.
That's the jetway, but a lot of airports didn't have them back then.
Yeah, which, and a lot of, like, if you fly into these smaller airports in like different countries and stuff.
Yeah, you go to the Caribbean, you're waiting on the stairs on the back of the pickup so that you can walk across the tarmac and get into the terminal.
I had to do that in Cincinnati, Ohio one time just because there was a lot of,
like they couldn't get you up there.
Construction going on at the airport.
Yeah. So. But that's, so they actually built airplanes. There's a DC-8 and the Boeing 727 that were built with stairs on the plane mm-hmm. to help people get off in case mm-hmm. you couldn't get off any other way.
Makes sense. Flo and Tina got all their passengers aboard, told them that they could sit wherever they wanted. So this is kind of like a today, like a Southwest Airlines.
Yeah, just sit down.
Yeah. Pulled the level to close the air stair and then strapped into their rear galley jump seats for takeoff. As the plane began to taxi towards the end of the runway, a man in a dark business suit sitting in the last row, the middle on the right, seat 18E, handed Flo a folded envelope and she pushed it into her pocket. Just as flight 305 began to pick up speed for takeoff, the man looked at Flo and said, "I think you better have a look at that note."
Well, first of all, why would she just put it in her pocket? Why wouldn't she look at it anyway?
There's a good reason Flo had ignored the man's note at first. TV and magazine campaigns of the day were still attempting to assure a wary public that the still novel mode of transportation was safe. And if air travelers wouldn't buy safe, maybe at least the businessman among them would settle for sexy. So stewardesses were treated, as sort of a sex object. Think of Hooters traveling 5 miles high at 500 miles per hour. One ad campaign touted its stewardesses with this slogan: "It's hard to find a woman who can remember what 124 people want for dinner."
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah.
Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Kelly?
Yes, it does.
That's what we're dealing with
here. Misogyny at its peak, I guess.
It was.
If a stewardess gained too much weight, got married, or, Lord forbid, found herself pregnant, she was forced to resign immediately. So, I mean, did she also just have to fit into the uniform that they gave her?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Was that a thing?
There was a weight limit in the whole thing. Yeah. Again, it's Hooters 5 miles high.
Were there weight limits on the pilots?
I'm sure.
Probably
there
not.
Were not.
They just factored that in with the fuel load.
Okay.
So it was no surprise to Flo at all that yet another creep in a suit was hitting on her. The major airlines' ad campaigns of the time practically insisted on it. But the man in the last row told her that she really should take a look at that note. As the plane prepared to lift off, Flo read these words: "You're being hijacked. I have a bomb here, and I would like you to sit by me." An hour or so before he handed that note to Flo Schaffner, a man identifying himself as Dan Cooper had bought a one-way ticket from Portland to Seattle. The ticket cost him $20, and he paid in cash.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. First class was $25 that day.
Oh, my God!
It was a 36-minute flight, but still, $5 more for first class.
Oh, my God.
Which is just insane in itself, but...
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
At the time, getting on a commercial jet was no more complicated than hailing a taxi cab. You walked up to the ticket counter, handed over your money, and then got on a plane. Dan Cooper was wearing a dark suit and tie with loafers and a dark raincoat. I mean, remember, we're in Washington, so I'm sure everybody had on a raincoat.
Right.
He also had a briefcase. It may as well have been ticking out loud because there was no metal detectors or luggage inspections. There was no security at the time in any U.S. airport. So I guess you can curse D.B. Cooper every time you fly, because that quickly became not the case.
He's the reason why there are metal detectors at every airport in the country. A long time before 9/11, and a lot of security increased after that. But you walk through a metal detector because of D.B. Cooper.
Mm. Which, I guess, at the time, it to me just seems insane now that you could ever get on an airplane without going through a metal detector. But, I mean, I guess you can get in a taxi without it going through a metal detector. So.
Yeah, you can get on a train. But, I mean, if they start blowing up trains, then we're going to have to... Nobody travels by train.
You probably can't get on a train anymore without going through a metal
probably
detector.
Probably not.
Can you?
I don't know. I've never traveled by train. I don't know.
Neither have I.
Yeah, unless you count the subway. And there, no. But that's just public transportation.
Are
we're talking
not
about
metal
Amtrak.
I guess you can't just, like, scan. I mean, getting on the subway, that would take ever have.
But, you know, Amtrak across the country, you probably do.
Some
dumbass has probably already tried that, and we just haven't done it on our podcast yet.
I mean, you have to go through a metal detector to get into Disney World. Mm-hmm. Like, to get into a lot of places.
I had to go through a metal detector to get into this office building today.
Some people have to go through them to go to school every day.
Yeah,
you're right.
Well, you can thank D.B. Cooper for that.
Okay. Thank you, D.B. Cooper.
After flight 305 got airborne and Flo Schaffner sat down beside him, Dan Cooper opened his briefcase and showed her what was inside. 6 thin red cylinders that looked like dynamite wrapped together with electrical tape, and a big battery with wires hanging out of it. Flo asked the man if he had a grudge against Northwest, and he said, "I don't have a grudge against your airline," he answered, "but I do have a grudge." Among other thoughts, Flo probably started to consider that she was going to be late for Thanksgiving dinner, not to mention possibly blown to bits at 25,000 feet. "Write this down," the man said to Flo. He wanted 4 parachutes, $200,000 in U.S. $20 bills, and a fuel truck waiting on the ground at the airport in Seattle. He told Flo to take the note to the cockpit and tell the pilots to pass along his demands to the airline and to the FAA. He instructed that the plane should circle in the sky above Seattle until his demands were met. That took 2.5 hours. Like I said, this was a 36-minute flight.
Yeah.
That took 2.5 hours, plenty of time for the FBI to ramp up into full panic mode. Cooper never said a word to anyone else that day except stewardess Tina Mucklow, who took Flo Schaffner's place in the seat beside him for the rest of the time he was on board. After Flo took Cooper's note to the cockpit, she stayed there with the flight crew for the rest of what turned out to be a very long evening. At Cooper's direction, the other 36 passengers on the plane were not made aware of the hijacking. That was until they got off the plane. When they finally landed in Seattle, Flo and the first class stewardess were allowed to leave, along with all the passengers, once the money and the parachutes had been brought on board. When the plane took off again, there were only 5 people still on the flight. The pilot, the co-pilot, the flight engineer, stewardess Tina Mucklow, and Dan Cooper. So Flo gets off the flight.
Flo gets off.
Now, why is Tina stuck on the flight?
Tina is the one who sat beside him. After Flo went up to the cockpit, she sat down beside him, and they kind of had this rapport between the two of them. So he felt comfortable with her. She wasn't scared. She wasn't frightened. I'm sure she was, but she didn't extend it outwardly. And so when it got time to throw everybody off the plane except the people he needed there, he wanted Tina to stay on the plane with him. And so she did.
Blame a mediocre journalist for the mistake that led the world to learn the hijacker's name as D.B. Cooper. But you have to admit, it is catchier than Dan.
It is catchier than Dan Cooper.
Mm-hmm. Where does the B come from?
Long story short, someone with a press pass screwed up somewhere and Dan Cooper became D.B. Cooper.
Yeah. There was a guy named D.B. Cooper who lived in Seattle who was sort of a criminal.
Okay.
And so the cops went out to look for him and just to see if it was him, and it wasn't. But somehow some journalist overheard that conversation, and Dan Cooper, which is what is written on the ticket that he purchased that day for $20, turned, by the time the media got a hold of it, it was D.B. Cooper, and that has stuck since.
So that's not accurate.
That's right. Mm-mm. Well, hey, us mediocre journalists have to stick together. I'm not going to throw the guy under the bus, whoever he was.
D.B. Cooper soon had more requests for Tina to relay to the flight crew. He wanted the plane to fly to Mexico as slowly as possible, with the landing gear down and the flaps on the wings set at 15 degrees. He wanted the plane going slowly enough that he could jump out the back using the air stairs beneath the tail of the plane. Spoiler alert.
Hello. That's how that ends.
One problem, at the slow speed, the plane did not have enough fuel to reach Mexico City. So Cooper negotiated with the flight crew to head for Reno, Nevada, for more fuel as Flight 305 made its way south. Cooper then put out the last of the cigarettes he smoked on the plane that night, which is insane. You could smoke cigarettes on a plane like...
The ashtray is still right there beside you on a lot of planes.
I was going to say
it's,
that.
It's still there. You can't use it anymore, but he crammed his cigarettes into one of those little ashtrays right there on the armrest.
Yeah, I have flown on several planes that still have those ashtrays.
You're on a 737, you probably still got ashtrays in the armrest.
Mm-hmm. He told Tina to pull the first class curtain closed behind her on the way to the front of the plane, and then stayed inside the cockpit with the door closed and locked until they landed in Reno. Tina said the last image she saw of Cooper was of him putting on one of the parachutes. A few minutes later, a light on the cockpit panel indicated that the rear air stair was being lowered. At the time, it was possible to do so on a Boeing 727 using the lever near the bulkhead door that separated the main cabin area from the aft stairs. A few minutes after the light lit up in the cockpit, everyone's ears popped when the air stair briefly slammed closed, as if it had sprung upwards after someone had just jumped off of it.
That's how they marked, hey, here's when he left. Mm-hmm. That was at like 8:11
so,
p.m.
Like, okay. The air temperature outside of Flight 305 was 22 degrees Fahrenheit. The sky was filled with low-hanging clouds, fog, and pelting raindrops. The plane was 10,000 feet off the ground, traveling at 200 miles per hour. When the plane landed in Reno later that night, FBI agents rushed aboard, but D.B. Cooper and the bomb and the money and two of the parachutes were no longer on board. All Cooper had left behind were 8 cigarette butts in the ashtray in the armrest of his seat, the black clip-on tie he had worn onto the plane, a few smeared fingerprints, and a mystery that has endured for 51 years and counting. And we'll be right back after a word from our sponsors.
So, the Post Herald here in Cherokee County is a sponsor of True Crime on Easy Street, and we are conducting a subscription drive. What we want you to do is subscribe to the paper, because in December, when the bowl matchups come out, we're going to put an entry list in the paper, and only subscribers to the Post Herald are eligible to win a $500 first place prize. You pick the most bowl game winners, you get $500.
College football bowl games.
College football bowl games.
All right, so step one, subscribe to the Post Herald.
Call 256-927-4476 to subscribe to the paper for as little as $20 a year, depending on your zip code. If you're right here in town, it's $20.
All right. That sounds wonderful. Shop Cherokee County first. Before you go out of town or shop online, Scott, visit many retail businesses here in Cherokee County. And you want to know why?
Please tell me.
Okay. They are faithful to support our local schools, our sports teams, our clubs, our community nonprofits, and more. So keeping your money here in the local economy, that's going to support all of that.
Teresa and Joy do a great job at the chamber. Amazon sucks. Shop local.
Absolutely agree.
Local businesses provide jobs for you and your neighbors. So brought to you by the Cherokee County Chamber of Commerce, shop local. I've seen you try to go out of town, Scott, and I'm not going to stand for it anymore.
I don't trust myself to drive out of town.
You better take your tail to the local shops from now on. Do you understand me?
I will do a much better job of shopping locally. Thank you for the Cherokee County Chamber of Commerce being a sponsor of the show and reminding us all to shop local.
Welcome back to our show. Thank you once again to our sponsors. And now back to our story.
So obviously, Katie Beth Givens just nailed the James Bond cold open. We have jumped out of a plane, and now we join in the search that has existed for all of these decades for D.B. Cooper. How deep down the rabbit hole do you guys want to go with this one? Because I can tell you right now, as far as I can see, there is no bottom.
Well, I've got questions.
Okay. All right. Good. Before we get started, I'm curious about one thing. Either of you guys ever been skydiving?
No.
No, but KT has twice.
Well, I don't give a shit about him. He doesn't listen to the show. He's dead to me. He's dead to me on Sundays from 12 to 1.
He did this years ago. As I understand it now,
yeah.
Unless you have a certain level or so many hours under your belt, you are jumping with the...
It's a tandem jump.
Yeah, you're attached.
You're attached to the guy who knows where the ripcord is.
Okay, so KT's done this twice, and neither time was he attached to a person.
Did he do static jumps?
So he did that where they were out on the line, like strung out on the line from the plane.
You don't have to pull it. It's when you jump 100 feet, you've got 100 feet of cord, it's going to pull it for you.
They actually had to pull theirs.
Oh, really?
Yep.
They had to pull. That's too much to remember when I'm falling.
It was a lot.
Through the sky.
And then he's also just sort of jumped just from the plane.
All right. How? Like, were the regulations not the same when he did it? Like,
I really don't know. I guess it was.
Let's not get anyone into trouble here.
No, this was a long time ago. This was before I had met Kevin. Mm-hmm. He was in college.
So he could be making up the whole thing.
No, I'm sure he's not.
Is that how he got you to marry him?
No.
We know KT. He's not really a lavish storyteller.
This is true.
Storyteller.
Yeah, he's more like one sentence will do.
I know that Jake.
I jumped out of an airplane once.
I know that Jake was involved in the first jump.
Okay.
Jake was not involved in the second jump.
Okay.
But I do know that the second time he just jumped out. And I think that he preferred it that way than to be flailing and flapping outside of the plane on that line.
I had a chance to go once. Katie, what's your story? Anything? Do you ever get close?
No.
No?
No, and I never will get close.
Yeah, me either. I missed my window on that. But I had a chance when I was in my 20s, a couple of buddies of mine drove over to Talladega and jumped out. They did the static. They did static jumps. So they were attached. You know, they hooked their pull cord. And when they jumped out of the plane, they fell for 5 seconds and then the chute pops open.
Oh.
I had a chance to do that. I chickened out the day before and told him I couldn't go. And I always thought about the old saying, if at first you don't succeed, then skydiving is not for you. So, and I stole that from the DB Cooper website. So to give them credit where credit is due.
I will never do it. I never had the desire to do it.
I was going to do it. And then I just flat chickened out.
I think that I would just pass out.
Yeah.
Yes. No, yeah. I'd get.
So a static jump for you. Hook it and jump.
No, it would have to be. I would have to be attached to someone because I'm not going to jump out of the plane on my own.
You're going to have to throw me out.
Somebody's going to have to go. Yeah, it's not going to happen.
All right, so back to the story. Katie just told us about the mostly undisputed facts of what happened inside Flight 305 on Wednesday, November the 24th, 1971. But there is plenty to disagree about everything else about this case. CooperCon 2022 just took place last week in Portland, Oregon. And I will guarantee you that somewhere there was an argument about the facts of this case between somebodies. Because if there's one thing I have learned in 3 weeks of researching this case, these people are passionate about their theories about what happened and what did not happen that night.
It's a pastime for a lot of individuals.
Yeah, it is. It really is. And so let's talk about the hijacking of Northwest Flight 305, NORJAC, as the FBI named their case.
Okay.
The basic description of Dan Cooper, before he was misidentified as D.B. Cooper, was a male around 45 years old, 6 feet tall, 175 pounds. He had black hair parted on the side. Or maybe his hair was a little wavy and greasy. He was a white man. Or maybe Hispanic. Depends on which eyewitness description you believe. There is a composite sketch of the hijacker that anyone can easily find online. Actually, there are three, at least. One of them looks like Bing Crosby. And it is called, wait for it, the Bing Crosby sketch.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good.
Well, the others do not look like Bing Crosby at all. And if you took the over on how many times we were going to say Bing Crosby on a podcast about D.B. Cooper, you just won the jackpot because the opening line was 3.5.
Well, I will say, if you're a white person with black hair, oftentimes people want you to be a certain race. I've got that my whole life. Like, are you Asian? Are you Hispanic?
Right.
Are you, like, that kind of gets thrown on you. And I think that's just people's,
well,
I don't know.
It's just so weird because of the 36 other passengers on the plane, I think if I'm going to get this number right, there are about 13 or 14 of them who were eyewitnesses to having seen him at some point at some distance in the cockpit, close or in the cabin, closer or not so close. And there's just not really a lot of consensus about his overall appearance. I mean, everybody can look at the sketch and go, yeah, that looks like him. Well, shit, that sketch looks like me.
Yes, he's just a plain-looking guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you guys are beginning to see what we're dealing with here. We are getting to the conjecture, the confusion, the speculation, the infatuation with the D.B. Cooper case and its Jason Voorhees-like ability to defy death for over 5 decades. Either you know what I'm talking about or you don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I've been around this case for years peripherally, but I've never really started to peel back the onion until we started getting ready for this episode. Here are a few details that anybody can find out about the man who hijacked Flight 305 with a simple cursory internet search. Cooper was an experienced skydiver. Or maybe not. He was a jet pilot. Possibly. He had once worked at Boeing. Or did he? He was a secret agent for the CIA who knew it was safe to jump out of the back of a 727 because he had already done it dozens of times in Vietnam. In fact, one theory proposes that the CIA worked to derail the NORJAC investigation in order to conceal the hijacker's identity and prevent the American public from finding out about all the illegal operations the CIA was involved in Vietnam at the time. Perhaps, too, DBC was simply an idiotic, desperate criminal with a death wish who somehow got lucky. Take your pick on any of those. You can find evidence to back almost any theory regarding exactly who D.B. Cooper was or was not. Maybe Cooper landed safely somewhere and got away with that 200 grand somehow. Maybe he was the same guy who tried the same exact crime 5 months later in Utah and got caught within 2 days, this time with $500,000, but with $499,970 of those dollars still unspent when they found the bag hidden in his house.
He'd spent $30.
That's right.
Well, I guess if you can buy an airplane ticket for $20, you can do a lot. It's yeah. $30.
Well, and he had coffee and a donut on the way home and still got busted.
So was it him?
That's a great question, Kelly.
Good
luck with that. Okay. Because you will go nuts trying to figure it out. Or maybe he was even unluckier than that and made a Wile E. Coyote-shaped hole in the ground at 120 miles an hour somewhere in the wilderness of the Pacific Northwest. Or maybe he landed in the Columbia River and drowned, or didn't drown. And any of those outcomes might help explain why none of the money has ever been spent. Which is not to say that none of that money has ever been found. Some D.B. Cooper sleuths out there believe that the hijacker took the name Dan Cooper based on a daredevil in a French language comic book. On the other hand, maybe the name was simply another confounding coincidence. There are plenty of those in Cooperland. And now, the three of us are all in the middle of Cooperland, and there is no map. I am nowhere near the bottom of this list, but I will stop after one more confusing Cooper riddle. Are you guys wearing your seatbelts?
Well, hold on. Let's get
because here comes a little turbulence.
Okay.
Maybe Cooper wasn't a man at all. There is one group of Cooper troopers out there who are thoroughly convinced that he was a she. Why not, right? If you're going to cook up a 50-year supply of hobo stew, you may as well toss in everything in the cupboard. Season to taste, and don't forget to stir the pot. You now understand what it means to be caught up in the Cooper vortex. That's a thing.
I want to get off this crazy carousel.
As of today, not yet. You've got 20 minutes to go. As of today, there have been hundreds of confessions, every one of them claiming to be D.B. Cooper, some of them deathbed confessions, at least a dozen by the latest count. I will update that number next week if necessary. Since the day of the crime, the FBI has investigated over 1,100 suspects. But somewhere along the way, the federal BI shot themselves squarely in the foot because you guys remember those 8 cigarette butts I mentioned?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Misplaced. Can't fucking find them. Don't know where they are.
The one thing with all the DNA in the world.
And if anybody who ever listens to this podcast and the three of us on this team of experts knows, all they needed was a little DNA and they could have solved this problem 20 years ago. But the FBI lost the evidence. And now you are beginning to understand why in July of 2016, the FBI said, fuck this. We're done with it. They walked away. They closed the case. That it's over.
Well, I mean,
as far as they're concerned,
how can they keep it open? What would they ever look at?
Yeah. How do you close it though, when it's not solved?
Well, they just said to hell with it.
They just said,
you guys want to work on it out there in Cooperland? Knock yourselves out. Sometimes they assist that Jeffrey Gray that Katie mentioned in the open. Mm-hmm. He wrote Skyjack. He has been able to see some of the FBI files through the years and the evidence. Some other folks they don't work with. It's kind of hit and miss.
I mean, really, if you think about it, this at this point is a waste of their time.
Yeah, right.
We've got a lot of active cases going on right now.
That's kind of the FBI's. Yeah. So in the absence of the FBI, today there are pockets of civilian detectives around the country who have become the primary investigators who are trying to dig all the way down into that deep, dark hole of a mystery. And as I mentioned earlier, there is no bottom so far. No. Remember that I said some of the money was found? Hmm? In 1980, 9 years almost after the crime took place, an 8-year-old boy on a picnic with his parents dug up around $6,000, three bundles, each containing $120 bills. He found them buried in the sand along the bank of the Columbia River in southern Washington state. Which reminds me, we never even discussed exactly when Cooper jumped or exactly where the plane was when that happened. And that's a whole other can of worms that we're going to leave sealed on the shelf in the cupboard. Dig it up if you want.
Gosh.
Back to the money in the sand, the FBI had a list of the serial numbers on all 10,000 of those $20 bills. That money was kept in banks around Seattle for the express purpose of ransoms. Mm-hmm. So there was a list of all of the serial numbers. They handed the money to Cooper in a canvas bag. And the numbers on the bills from that $6,000 that the little boy found on the banks of the Columbia River matched.
So were they just scattered or were they in bags?
They were stacked. No, they were stacked on top of each other, mm-hmm. buried in the sand. It depends on who you ask exactly what they looked like when they got there. But the little boy said when he pulled them out of the sand, the rubber bands were still attached, still in one piece. But as he fiddled with them in his hands, the rubber bands came apart. And they actually reached out to the company that made the rubber bands and said, how long does it take your rubber bands to deteriorate? And they said, I don't know, 6 months. So it's hard to know exactly what happened. I mean, there's a theory that it floated down the river over the course of 8 years. There's a theory that somebody buried it there 6 months before it was found.
Mm-hmm.
Another deep, dark hole in the story that is D.B. Cooper.
Okay. Because I was going to say, if they're stacked there, then that may be evidence that he survived the jump.
Right,
at least,
yeah.
And buried him.
Well, there's one theory that he survived, buried his money, and came back 3 or 4 days later. Maybe it was in the dark when he came back to get it, and he inadvertently left three bundles of money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's digging it up. Maybe he sees headlights. He's trying to throw all the money in a bag and get away with it, and he leaves three there. Mm-hmm. Or that he died on impact with the Columbia River and it floated down over the course of 8 years. Mm-hmm. Although it's upstream and not downstream, but that, you know what? You don't want to go there. You can piss somebody off at CooperCon.
I don't
if you say the wrong thing about those.
I don't want to do that.
About those $20 bills.
Yeah.
Among all of the Cooper veterans out there who were trying to crack this case and get to the bottom of the 20s and everything else, there were a couple who were kind enough to reach out to us when I requested from my rookie perspective some facts about the case. Both of these guys are very good at what they do. They are experts on the Cooper case, and they are working honestly and diligently to try and share accurate information and work to a conclusion. Darren Schaefer is the host of a podcast called The Cooper Vortex. He told me he is, quote, a podcast fan turned podcaster who cannot stop talking about D.B. Cooper, unquote. And so far, he hasn't. Mm-hmm. He and his friend Russell Colbert have recorded over 50 episodes to date. They're probably working on another one right now.
All on D.B. Cooper.
Yes. Each of those, which run anywhere from 1 hour to 2 hours, includes an interview with someone who is convinced that he or she knows the identity of D.B. Cooper or has a fresh angle on some obscure fact about the case, some of which we have already mentioned.
Okay. 50 different episodes.
Yes.
And they're all interview episodes. And that's neat.
With a different person who is convinced.
Every time.
Oh my gosh.
Here are the titles of just a handful of these episodes.
Okay.
To give you an idea of exactly how much we don't know about D.B. Cooper. One episode is titled, D.B. Cooper is Alive, which is unlikely for multiple reasons. Most of all, because he was 45 and 71 and he'd be in his late 90s now.
Mm-hmm.
But hey, somebody thinks that's the thing. Another, D.B. Cooper was an international spy. There's Katie's James Bond cold open.
Okay.
Here's another one. D.B. Cooper escaped from Alcatraz, which reminds me, I want us to do the Alcatraz escape at some point in the future on this podcast. Here's another one. A tie-in that will ring a bell with some of our listeners. D.B. Cooper was the Zodiac Killer.
Oh my gosh.
Hey, if you're going to kill two birds with one stone, right?
Right.
Why not?
Yep.
And my favorite of them all, for obvious reasons, D.B. Cooper lived in Alabama. And there's our home state tie.
How about that?
Yeah, you see how I worked that in? I saved it till the end.
That.
I know. Schaefer and Colbert have been at it since 2018. So if you want to hear some interesting interviews with people connected to the Cooper case, some more peripherally than others, but that's okay. He always has a good time with it. He does a great job. Check out the Cooper Vortex podcast.
I'm going to. Mm-hmm.
Another name that will be familiar to the well-versed Cooper sleuths out there is Eric Ulis. U-L-I-S. He has been on the trail of D.B. Cooper for well over a decade and has been featured on several documentaries about the Cooper case. History Channel, Discovery. I've watched a lot of them. He's great. Ulis is the administrator of the D.B. Cooper Mystery Group Facebook page. He was kind enough to grant my request to join his private group, and I have learned a lot about the case from the conversations I have read from the 3,300 members of the group. Last week at CooperCon 2022 in Portland, Ulis released brand new information related to a possible new suspect in the case. Look it up. So there are people out there working this case every day, and I recommend Ulis highly as someone that you should listen to if you want to learn more about D.B. Cooper and the hijacking of Flight 305. Guys, that's just about all I have time for today. We've scratched the surface barely. I'm not even sore from scratching. That's how barely we have scratched the surface of the D.B. Cooper case. If you want to do some more digging, we've given you some names. The Cooper Vortex.
I'm going to.
Ulis's Facebook page. Mm-hmm. There's so much that we don't know about the case, but here's one thing that we all know for certain, and we talked about this earlier. If you walk into an airport today and try to get on a plane, you're walking through a metal detector, and you have D.B. Cooper to thank for that.
That's right.
Because in 1973... the Federal Aviation Administration mandated passenger screenings at every airport in the country. They also ordered Boeings to alter the aft stairways on their 727s so that you couldn't open them while they were in the air.
See,
seems like a huge oversight.
I thought if you open something on an airplane like that in the air, that everything... I mean, do movies tell you nothing? Does everything not just get sucked out?
It would be if the cabin is pressurized. But D.B. Cooper was smart enough to say, I want you to not pressurize the cabin. So all that you have to do to make sure the cabin is not pressurized is open that aft bulkhead door, mm-hmm. which it's a closed stairway. It just looks like stairs facing you in the face. But when you pull that lever and the stairs go down, but if the plane's already not pressurized, that's why he wanted to stay below 10,000 feet. You breathe air. You can breathe air at 10,000 feet just the way you do now.
But if you get above that, you have to pressurize the cabin.
You have to pressurize the cabin or people are going to pass out because they can't breathe.
So
he knew that.
That's what made me think that maybe he had had some military experience.
Exactly. There's a huge portion of the Cooper sleuths who believe that he must have had some military experience and probably from the CIA in Vietnam because they used the same airplane. They used a Boeing 727 with the aft stairway to drop troops and food and things into parts of Vietnam where they weren't supposed to be operating. Air America, you guys have all heard of CIA's covert air operation called Air America. That's it. So there's some people who think if anybody knew how to do this, it's somebody who had already done that. So that's a huge theory that makes perfect sense.
And why did he want multiple parachutes?
He wanted two back parachutes that you wear on your back, right? Two main packs. I forget exactly the term. I don't know the terminology. And then two front parachutes. And so what you would do typically is you would attach the front parachute to some clips, some rings on the straps, so that if your back parachute didn't open for some reason, you'd have an extra.
He just had all the backups.
He wanted backups. The pilots thought, he wants one of us to jump with him. He's going to hold one of us hostage, mm-hmm. too. Mm-hmm. So there was a thought that maybe the FBI was going to give him a dummy chute and let him fall to his death. But he knew enough about parachutes that he checked all of the chutes.
He had done this before.
He had done something.
He had jumped out of an airplane.
Because he knew what to do. He knew to check. There's a card that is stored in every parachute pack. That the person who packs that chute signs it and says, I packed it, I did it right. But it's not in an obvious place. But Tina Mucklow said at one point she saw him looking at that card. So he knew where the card was to confirm that it had been packed properly. One of the parachutes, Katie, to answer your question, one of the front packs, he took it out. They found it in the airplane when the FBI rushed the plane in Reno after it landed. He had taken the parachute out of the bag and cut some of the straps, they think, to make a rope. So he put the money in the empty bag where the front parachute was. Mm-hmm. and tied it up good so we wouldn't lose it on the way down.
Oh, wouldn't that be hilarious?
But nobody
knows. Money just went flying through.
Well, and that, you know, that's the whole speculation. You can find folks who think that that $6,000 found on the Columbia River edge was money that flew out when he jumped and got lost. So, or that he, that the guy, Richard McCoy, who did the same thing 5 months later in Utah and got away with $500,000 for 2 days, they think he did it again because he jumped and he lost the $200,000. So he had to go do it again. Listen, rabbit hole.
Plausible.
Every rabbit hole has 10 rabbit holes on this story. It's crazy. It's nuts. But I love it. It's one of my favorite things. I've always been a fan of this D.B. Cooper case. I'm so glad that you guys let me do it today because I love it. It's so fun.
It is
because
very
there's no bottom. It can be whatever you want it to be. You pick.
And no one died. Except maybe him.
Except maybe D.B. Cooper. Yeah. Whoever the hell he was.
Well, what about the flight crew? Did they say anything else about him? I know they've talked
about... The flight
about...
crew never spoke to him. Okay. The only person he ever spoke to was Florence Schaffner the first time when she went up and gave the initial ransom request.
Uh-huh. And then
And then she stayed in the cockpit. And then Tina Mucklow was the only other person who ever communicated with him for the entire time. I think he was on that plane for... 4 or 5 hours. Yeah. It was 2.5 hours while they circled to get the stuff. And then not that long. I think it was within 30 minutes of takeoff from Seattle towards Reno that he exited the plane. I think the plane left at like 7:40 and by 8:11, they had the bump in their ears and they think that's when he jumped because then the stair retracted temporarily and slammed against the cockpit and boom, everybody got, you know, when you drive up the mountain here at San Rock, your ears pop. Their ears popped.
What did she say about him as far as his personality, his... I feel like Tina would have known a little more about him than anybody else.
Well, here's the thing. Tina gave a few interviews to the FBI after it all happened. Mm-hmm. But within a few years, and I forget exactly what the timeline is, she disappeared off the face of the earth for like 15 years. She's back now.
Good Lord.
But she disappeared off the face of the earth for like 15 years. It turns out... she had joined a convent and became a nun.
Oh.
Yeah.
From flight attendant to nun.
Yeah. Apparently she was very religious, though. I mean, Flo tells a story in one book about how she was always quoting the Bible and asking if she'd been saved. So she was a very religious person. Tina is. She's still alive as far as I know.
I wonder if that's why he found her peaceful and calming sitting next to him because she's
probably
had
why
that.
She didn't panic, you know, she had that inner peace.
Yeah, she's like, hey, if this thing blows up, I'm going to heaven.
Yeah.
Right. Because Flo was frantic.
Mm-hmm.
That's why Flo, get out
that's
of here.
That's why he
go sit in the cockpit.
That's why he got rid of Flo. He said,
well, I'm not sure exactly how that happened, but yeah.
Flo laid eyes.
She was frantic. She thought she was gonna die.
Flo laid eyes on the explosives.
Yes.
That's true. She did see the bomb.
And Tina's like, if I go, I go.
Yeah.
Tina see the bomb?
At some point, because he kind of, depending on which book you read, he kind of held the briefcase open just so that his hand was in it as if to imply that his finger was on the trigger. So you know, don't mess with me or I'll blow this thing up.
Here's the thing.
Tina had to light his cigarettes for him. She lit all of those cigarettes for him using a book of matches. That he insisted that she give back to him before he sent her to the front of the plane because he's worried about fingerprint evidence, right? So, but she lit his cigarettes because he's got one hand occupied in the briefcase.
But he wasn't worried about his fingerprints on the cigarettes.
I guess not.
Well, I guess it wouldn't have because been his fingerprints them there. On the cigarettes. I guess it would have been his.
It wouldn't
saliva.
Be fingerprints.
Yeah, but nobody had ever heard of that.
Yeah,
in 1971, nobody had heard of it.
Oh, he's holding them between the.
Yeah.
The two fingers.
Yeah, right. Yeah. He's no fingerprints here. Smoking, blowing, jam it in. And I'm
How's he pulling them out of the cigarette box?
I'm not
sure. Tina's probably doing it.
Probably Tina's lighting them, handing them to him, and lighting them for him.
There's some holes there, but.
Listen, the FBI totally screwed up this whole thing. Big time.
Well,
I don't think he had a real bomb.
Maybe not.
That was going to be my question.
Maybe not, but
really. Just going to. Blow himself to smithereens.
Because he's sitting there smoking right over a bomb.
Over dynamite.
Hey, if he's the mad, crazy criminal with a death wish that we supposed.
I don't think he had a death wish.
Then it doesn't matter. I don't think he did
he
either.
Had extra
but
parachutes.
If he was, But if he was, then what does he care? And that's what you have to work in. You have to bake that into the cake if you're the FBI, right?
I guess so. It's just weird that he's
give him the $200,000 and catch him when he lands. It worked great 5 months later when Richard Hickok did it, or Richard McCoy did it.
Mm-hmm.
They found him within 2 days.
Yeah.
But, you know, Cooper jumped over.
He had an extra
supposedly
parachute.
Jumped.
But never spent any of the money.
Never a dime. Now, listen, let's keep this in mind. Mm-hmm. If you're going to spend that money, what they did back then was they sent a piece of paper, a lot of paper, to every grocery store for 100 miles, and it was up to the cashier, if somebody handed her a $20 bill,
to
run it. And they weren't sequential. They were just randomly generated numbers in that pile of money. 10,000 numbers.
No.
So who knows if it got spent or not.
And
it was a $20 bill.
If he made it,
if he made it to Mexico like he wanted to originally.
Yeah.
Like, are they running it in Mexico?
No, they're not running it.
Of course not. And what if he's Canadian? What if that Dan Cooper angle about the comic books? What if he came up with the name Dan Cooper because he's from Canada? Because Dan Cooper was a daredevil who jumped out of airplanes. He was a pilot for the Royal Canadian Air Force in the comic books. It would be like you and me picking Superman or G.I. Joe to be our nom de plume if we were going to pull off a crime.
Okay, so Dan Cooper is
Dan Cooper was Canadian. The name of the main character in the comic book.
It's Canadian.
And it was Canadian. The comic book was only ever issued in French. So you had to be from the Quebec area, or at least you had to speak French to read the comic book. As far as I know, it's never been translated into English. I think there's a business model there. Maybe we can get on that. I don't know.
Did they ever say what sort of accent he might have used?
Very generic, no accent to speak of. Midwestern, they said, just no accent. You know, he sounded like Walter Cronkite. He sounded like an American.
Okay, but he didn't sound like someone from Canada.
But some folks said his complexion was more olive, like maybe he was, like I mentioned, Hispanic, so maybe he was from Central America, but someone else says, no, that's not right. Mm-hmm. I mean, eyewitness testimony is horribly unreliable, as we've mentioned several times on this show.
Terrible.
So, I mean, guys, you see what we're doing here. We're sitting around talking. This episode ended 10 minutes ago, and we are still sitting around talking about it. That's what happens. I want to go to CooperCon and just do this sit around and talk about all the things that I don't. And listen, there's a million things that we did not even discuss. It's crazy. It's 50 years old, and it gets... Mm-hmm. The volumes just grow by the day.
How many interviews did Tina grant after she was...
There were a couple with the FBI. There was one the next day. I mean, everybody had a horrible Thanksgiving, of course. And then another interview in December, I think. And then she kind of disappeared for a while. And then she came back. If you watch there's a great documentary about this case on HBO Max.
All right, I'm going to watch it. I love their documentary.
You'll just have to do D.B. Cooper. I forget the exact title. But Tina is there. She's a part of the episode.
I want to hear from Tina.
Yes.
Is Flo on the episode?
I don't think so. I don't think Flo is, but they talk to a couple of people who are convinced, you know, those deathbed confessions that we mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple of those that are in there. There's a couple of other folks who are convinced that their relative, their uncle or their brother-in-law or whatever was D.B. Cooper. And they are all just 110% convinced that they're right. One person can be.
What is the benefit to, on your deathbed, confessing to being D.B. Cooper?
Is it just to get the satisfaction of a job well done? I fooled these idiots for 50 years.
Or is it to clear your conscience because you have stolen?
Yeah. Well, if you are him, but if you're not, which only one of them can be, right? So the other 11, if we're talking about 12 deathbed confessions, what are the other 11 doing?
Yeah,
just trying to piss off their wife. This, hey, one last fuck you before I go into the great hither and yon.
I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't understand what your benefit would be.
Can I tell you guys something?
Yeah.
I am D.B. Cooper.
Yeah, no, you're not.
You just said you were one. I'm over here.
You were minus 15 then or whatever you were.
Oh, Lord, your math is off.
Yeah, I forget. Anyway, guys, that's how fantastically ridiculous this is, and thanks to Eric Euless and Darren Schaefer for their help And hope you, if you want to learn more,
I'm going to listen to their podcast.
A great place to start.
Yes, I'm going to listen to their podcast. I'm going to watch the documentary. It's Thanksgiving week. I'm going to kick back. I've got nothing
else to do.
I'm off work this week. I'm going to do this. This
put down the turkey sandwich.
I'm putting it
back. And pick up your phone.
I was going to say, you can eat and listen to a podcast.
Yeah, that's true.
Perfect.
You can. That's true.
Gobble, gobble. Happy Thanksgiving.
Have a happy and safe Thanksgiving, everyone.
Good night, everybody.